Katie, I thought we'd bring in Sarah Courtney. Sarah is
awesome.
A great student of McLuhan, so let's bring in Sarah, see if she has anything to say about what we're going to say. So,
okay.
What's the issue?
Hi.
Hey, Sarah.
Hey.
Sarah.
Hey. Yeah, I was looking forward to tuning in. I love
it. Good.
You like the music, Sarah?
Yeah, it was great.
I agree. Okay, so are we doing Ulysses? What's happening tonight?
Yeah, I thought we'd talk about Kevin's book, if that's okay.
Okay, yeah, okay, let's go. I listened to it.
Okay, so did you look at anything that I sent you, or do I need to just talk?
I didn't read the article. I just listened to his interview. One of the interviews.
Okay, so Sarah, this is a book that was written by Kevin Birmingham. It's called The Most Dangerous Book, The Battle for James Joyce Ulysses. And he's in his late 20s. He went to Harvard, and now he teaches history and literature or something at Harvard. But he wrote this book. It came out in June in time for Bloomsday, and it's about the obscenity trial behind Ulysses. But it also gets into Joyce's life, how he was inspired to write the book, his creative process, and then it's really like a biography of Ulysses. It's really, really well researched. Footnotes, but there's no way to explain the book. Every page actually is just packed with so much information, and it was really fun to read. He wrote it like in a really sensationalist way. I could totally see this being a movie. Johnny Depp could play Ezra Pound. There were a lot of really cool bohemian people in it. Jim. I don't know, but it was just fun to read. And I found it on James Joyce's Facebook page and I read it in about 3 sittings. So he talked about James' life a lot, and I'm just going to say a little bit about some main things that I thought were cool about the way the book was structured, and then I can get into facts, and you guys interrupt whenever you want to. But the main thing that was neat was that he talked about how James wrote these, which were little of profound everyday things, and he would write down on scraps of paper and then copy it into a manuscript. And that was how his process went. And, Bob, that reminded me so much of the video that you did with Roxana when you're standing in front of the Egyptian figure. It's just me standing, kneeling. You talked about how for a long time in storytelling, everything had to be linear. Do you remember that part in the video?
When I'm kneeling down and looking at
You're in Santa and you have the earphones on, so you're listening to the commentary in the little headphones of what you're looking at. And it's got the throne. And first he's standing and then he's kneeling. And you explain how it's the same guy that they're showing.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's the latest video. That's the latest one. Books,
yeah.
Bob Books and something. Yeah, that's a good one.
So
very good.
Cool, because Joyce changed the way. It wasn't a linear way of telling stories. It was these epiphanies. So
yeah.
I thought that kind of drew back to what you were setting up. Like you were setting up for that. It also talked a lot about James' blindness and suffering.
Hey, Katie, your phone is breaking up. Maybe you should hang up, call back in.
I will.
Maybe, yeah. So Sarah, you take over, or I'll come running in. So, Sarah, what do you say about James Joyce?
He might anyway.
I know. Quick, Sarah, quick. Talk, Sarah.
I was going to say that it is sort of that Baroque spiral when you're reading you're reading Ulysses, because you think something about what you're reading, and then suddenly the character that's speaking explains it to you, and you're like going inside of their head, inside of their head, inside of their, you know, it's really just a lovely progression of reading those words. It's a book that anybody can pick up, whether you're schooled, which I'm not, in James Joyce or any of that, any of this subject, and be able to understand as well as somebody who is a scholar, you know?
Yep. That's the issue. Do you want
Sarah, will you just repeat what you said? I'm so sorry, I just called back in, but
yeah, she said
really
a good point. She said that it's a Baroque spiral, which is a term for my chart, which is based on the Baroque spirals of Finnegan's Wake. So Ulysses begins the Baroque spirals of retrieving earlier parts of the book and also going inside the person. So it's a vertical spiral and a horizontal spiral.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. And the perspective, you know, he brings out so many different points of view as you're reading it. You really have to pay attention. And, you know, I think it's
now, here's what's interesting. Now, here's what McLuhan would say about it. You have cubism. You've got Freud. You've got Einstein all around 1904, 1905 into 1915. So cubism, multi-locational. You got Ulysses, multi-locational. And that's because the movie and the Telegraph newspaper and the telephone were making people perceive things multi-locationally. And so the artist presented first and the avant-garde scientists. But the medium made them think this way. Made it evoke the art. So Ulysses responded to a felt need in the population. They didn't know they were feeling it, and then they see cubism, and they say, that's strange, or Ulysses is strange, and they even ban it because it's too close to the present action of the mixed media of that day. Too profound, what I just said?
No, I'm so sorry to interrupt anybody.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, I had to mute. My dog's barking.
Yes, go ahead, Katie.
Okay, back the second point that I want to make sure that I make in case Ian calls in was I love the clips that
Ian's
you played.
Ian's right here.
About.
He's lurking. He's waiting for an opportunity to speak. But if you keep focused, he'll
whenever.
Be correct.
And I've got questions for Ian about this and other
things. No, don't mention Ian.
Okay.
Don't direct your attention. Okay, I got to mute Ian. Okay. I'm muting Ion. Katie, don't do that. Don't address him.
All right, I'll
unmute him.
So the other part that I thought was really fabulous was the clips that you played tonight interspersed with the music with your and Carolyn's private session with Ion talking about all of the women surrounding you. Well, that mirrors Joyce's life so clearly, which I had mentioned to you earlier. But you've got Margaret Anderson and Jane Heap publishing the Little Review, and Sylvia Beach, and Virginia Woolf, and all these women around Joyce just
Gertrude Stein and Alice.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you'd have Gertrude Stein and Alice. And, you know, Margaret Anderson ended up with a Gurdjieff circle around Gurdjieff, and I think she got ill, maybe even died from it.
Jane Heap, both of them went and met Gurdjieff.
Yes, yeah. So you're saying, these women were attracted to Joyce.
They adored him. Like they straight up adored him. He was adorable. They'd starve for him. They'd go to jail for him. They slept in a cot for him.
Just like an Ionette would. Any Ionette here would do that for Carolyn, at least Carolyn, but me, and probably me.
Well, probably both of you, for sure.
Yes.
Where he was different, though, was he really was pathetic and kind of a thinker. I mean, and fabulous, too. And you're not that much of a thinker.
No, I improve on Joyce. No, you'll see. Joyce is in my quadrant on the chart. And so I'm a holopathic cliche probe or retrieval, but improvement on Joyce. I do it better than he did.
Right.
He groped for Ion.
Same birthday.
Didn't get there.
Same birthday. Yeah.
I am the perfect golden baby.
You are. And Joyce was also arrogant. When he met Yeats, and Yeats was 36, Joyce said to him, "We've met too late. You're too old for me to have any effect on you." So he was so pompous because he thought he was a genius, and people in literary circles typically do go through a phase where they think they're geniuses, but he really was a genius. And he was kind of criticized for that, but it could have just been pomposity. Like, you're like that.
I take it. I'm an actually very humble person. This is what Roxana realized. She thought I was some Clint Eastwood guy out for justice, and then she found I was a sweet little boy who could break dance with 10-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
She was very impressed with my sweetness. I'm not even a man, you know. That's the difference.
Mayor Blackwoman. Well, I have questions for Ion about this. Do you want to bring...
Please, not yet, not yet. Let's see what Sarah's got to say. I mean, you want
to
say, Kevin, I think you've said the main point. The main point is that you realized Joyce was like me. That's what you realized.
Right.
Yes.
That's what I realized.
Early crude. He was a troubleshooter. He broke through whatever Ion Dim was going to be. He was a tough Western, you know, wide earth on the frontier and had to be tough. They broke through for Bob to come in to be a gentle slacker, surfer, baseball player, hockey player, did not play Monopoly. I did not do that, but didn't even play chess. Yes, I was around, available. As someone was saying, go ahead.
Had you heard that Joyce's eye problems were attributed to syphilis? Supposedly that was revealed in this book by Kevin. Where had you heard that before?
There's much rumor about his syphilis for decades, and I asked Ion and the Evergreens about it, and I can't remember what they said, whether he had syphilis or not. I think he didn't, though everybody thought he did.
Kevin found that he had been prescribed a medicine that was only used to treat syphilis, and that was his conclusion. So I guess he's supposed to be the first person that has proof of this. Through sifting through letters and papers, he found that out.
Okay, well, we'll check with that. So, Sarah, do you have any say? Did I cut Sarah off? Is Sarah here?
No, I unmuted. I love this story. When I heard about Breaking Bad, it was already like 2 years, two seasons down. And so I was binge watching. And as I was watching that, I thought, oh my gosh, this is the modern Ulysses story.
Yeah.
It's the same story, but just the android name version.
It's also an Ionette story. You get Ionized, you get on the drops, and everybody bugs you, and you have some idiot probably married to you, and you're a total idiot. You know, that young kid was driving up the wall constantly, right? Some lover or something. Yeah, it's totally... So Ulysses is the Ion trip, or the Ionette journey. Campbell would say it's a hero's journey, but nah, it's way more than that. And remember, Joyce consulted... It's his own journey, and he consulted gypsies all the time. You know, he used the astral plane as much as he could. And, you know, Ulysses does. Then Ezra Pound starts the cantos with Ulysses consulting a medium.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big deal, this mediumship back then, the cult of Apollo at Delphi. You know, in Ion.
Mm-hmm.
In Ion, the Ionic Peninsula. There's something about us retrieving that Ionic scene where Ion comes in and explains exactly what was going on there, the limitations of those nymphs, whatever, channeling something in the volcanic mists. And then we're here in the volcanic mists of Hawaii, and Ion is before literate Greece, and we've gone back there. So that Plato, as we said last week, he smears Ion and says, oh, divine trancing, that's not poetry, because they were favoring the Homeric writing things down. But we're the opposite. We don't want to write things down. We want to speak. That's what Ion is getting his revenge on the literary world of Plato and Aristotle. Because electric media favors the Ionic bias, the Ionic talent, the divine trance. So back to you, Katie. What's thoughts? What more
did
Kevin
say? What was that question?
What more did Kevin say?
He talked a lot about Joyce's eye surgeries and how gruesome that was and how he had leeches on his eyes and laid in bed writhing in pain and glaucoma and multiple surgeries. And it was really gruesome. I didn't realize how horrible that was for him.
Right, and, you know, Lewis goes blind, Beethoven goes deaf. I mean, these artists, they still create even though they're really got handicaps. That's pretty amazing.
It was was amazing. I just wonder if all that pain might have helped him in a way, because he had to, he was under blankets for months at a time, and he would reach for scraps of paper and try to write stuff down. Sometimes he would write really big just to play with the words. Like, he really wanted to use the words like paint. I guess how Sheila would do with her paint, where there's that point where you're really playing with them on a palette and mixing to get the right color of silver or whatever she's trying to do. Like, he really wanted to do that with pencil. His manuscripts were horrible. He had like 9 typists going all the time, and they hated it. And then they would realize what they were typing and have to stop because it was so disgusting they couldn't bear to type it.
sounds like Ion on a radio show or something, or on a network.
It does. Well, then you played that song about your, but I'm not saying it, but whatever the
lyrics. Yeah, yeah, we can't say that stuff. We
Which
just
was
play
perfect
it.
For, it was perfect for this, too. And then I wonder, too, when he was spending all that time in Nighttown, if he wasn't talking to the prostitutes as much as he was engaging them sexually. Evidently,
yeah, I think that's a good point. Let me say this. Generally, many women in the 50s and 60s, when they first were allowed to read Ulysses, they were shocked at the last chapter of Molly's Private Thoughts. They said they were amazed that a man could catch the sensibility of a woman so accurately. That was sort of the view of pre-baby boomer women and maybe baby boomer women. You know, I don't know if the Sarah generation, who we can also talk about Sarah's painting as well as Sheila's, because Sarah, as an INS,
yeah, Sarah's
painter.
Awesome.
Yeah, so we can do two different styles. They're competing schools, the Sarah school and the Sheila school. Very, very different. I would say that Sheila's the vertical symbolist and Sarah is the horizontal symbolist. You can look at my collection of McLuhan quotes to see the definition difference of each.
Well, Sarah does a lot of collage, though, too.
Yeah, that's the horizontal.
To her painting and drawing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the horizontal symbolism, whereas the straight and narrow and the perspective and the proper matching, that's Sarah's. I mean, that's Sheila's, and that's vertical symbolism.
And Sarah's really got the female form down. She draws some beautiful, hippie women. She's got the hands and the hips and all that. Just incredible.
Yeah, we're not talking about you, big Sarah. I'm talking about little
Sarah.
Yeah,
I know.
I'm
talking about Sarah.
You have it.
Sarah is Molly Bloom.
No. Sarah's not Molly Bloom.
No.
She's Stephen. She's Sedlin.
Yeah.
The frustrated artist, the snob.
Molly
hates
Molly
everybody.
Singer. Yeah.
You're Molly. You're there in university, single, screwing all the professors that pass through under the guise of fundraising. You know, you're Molly.
Well, Molly was educated, though, and Sarah is. So there's a difference.
That's right. Sarah's not educated. Sarah comes from Baton Rouge, or wherever. She's not even from any. She's from all over the place. She's an army brat or something. It's Sarah, this is old Sarah Courtney. She doesn't have any education. She's self-taught, like Molly.
Oh, okay. I thought you just said she was college professors.
She's in the secretary position. She's at the front desk, you know. She doesn't do the actual work. She just is the PR for the nice-looking girl sitting in the front that calms the professors, their jet lag down. That's what Sarah does.
I wish. Yeah.
See, she wishes it, like Molly.
No, because Sarah last week was doing great impressions of people that she met in D.C. And then I think Molly was supposed to be really good at mimicking people styles and stuff. He writes.
We have to update. Since Finnegan's Wake is a more complex version of Ulysses, so Finnegan's Wake represents Quadrophenia, so every one of us is every person in Ulysses. So, yeah, Sarah, Stephen, Molly, Bloom, couple of violent people in the taverns, you know, punkers. So, and we're all that. Finnegan's Wake shows that we all become.
I'm going to go back to my theory that Portrait of a Young Man is Shem and Ulysses is Sean and Finnegan's Wake is H.C.E.
Well, wait, you're saying Leopold is Sean? Okay, so Stephen, talking about the Stevens. So Stephen and Portrait of Shem and You know, I think it's the reverse. I think the respectable altar boy in Portrait, so that would be Sean, but the detached, alienated Stephen and Ulysses, that's more like Shem, as Shem is presented.
No, I think of who James Joyce was when he was writing those books, and when he was writing Portrait, he was Shem.
Okay, so
really in his life.
Well, McLuhan made a point. No, Sarah, listen to this. Richard Ellman came out with the first in-depth biography in 1959. It's interesting to read McLuhan's review of Ellman. Ellman goes on to become a sir, you know, made by Queen Elizabeth, and ends up at Oxford. So his book goes into every little personal detail. And McLuhan says this book will ruin all freshman exposure to Joyce because it's too much personal details. McLuhan said there was no James Joyce in Portrait of the Artist. It was a portrait of a conventional pre-Raphaelite poet of the late 90s and early noughts of that period. And Joyce was not that kind of guy. Now, you could say that's Shem or Sean, but it's not James Joyce. And so if you don't agree with McLuhan, at least you've got to understand the case that McLuhan made to consider. You consider that point because it's not said much. Get my point there? You get that? Get my contribution?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Yeah, it's just that pattern seemed to come out to me.
Right, well, then you're not a professor. You're just a secretary. What do you know? You know what I mean? You're just
going
along with your users. uneducated people emphasize the user's content. They project their own selves too much. Now, Katie, she's trying to develop not projecting herself. See, Katie's the intellectual among this group right now, the wannabe professor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, we all agree that, right, Katie? You agree with that?
Straight up. Virginia Woolf, when she read it, at first hated it, and Kevin said that after she read it, it worked on her for a little while and felled her like bullets from the inside.
Yeah.
I think there's so much.
And remember, she was born the same year as Joyce. This is interesting. She, Wyndham Lewis, and Joyce are interesting triumvirate at the same year, 1882. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
I did, as I was reading this week, I also have been references. I wasn't going to do that, but I found a way to do that that was quite enjoyable without using a compendium, so I'm going ahead and doing that. And if you really read this book and take the time to do that, it's the whole of literature, too.
Yeah.
Like you get a whole literary education in the book.
Yeah, by reading the annotations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Except for there's this really... Go ahead.
No, you have something to say. Go ahead.
Blaney, this fabulous, fabulous Irish man who then moved to Britain, does a 5-minute podcast. In 5-minute segments, it's really fun to listen to. I'm going to do the whole
thing. You're blipping out. You're saying somebody has made a podcast, 5 minutes of each chapter of Ulysses. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's 5-minute sound bites going through everything. Like the whole thing, all of the literary references, making it really interesting. I'm going to listen to all those.
Okay, you're breaking up. But what are you saying? 5 minutes on each page or each line? We're not even getting to the basic point.
No, they're 5-minute podcasts, and he goes through the whole book, like 5-minute chunks.
Oh, okay, good.
You can just take your little bit.
Okay, so maybe you have to hang up and call back in. So let's bring...
What about Jacques Derrida? That he spent months just sitting in a library reading Ulysses.
Yeah.
He wrote a book about it. I don't.
No, they all did. They all got. You know what they did? You know how they got into Joyce? Because McLuhan's The Medium is Massage, and then Warm in 67, and Warm Peace and Gold Village in 68 had all these quotes from Finnegan's Wake, and they were produced in France, partly because of Expo 67, which brought in De Gaulle and the French interest through the Quebec-Montreal scene. So all these French guys started noticing McLuhan because he was commenting on Joyce, and I think they were just getting the first translations of Joyce in the late 60s. So they were influenced by McLuhan, so they become very abstract. And, you know, the famous James Joyce Society meeting in Paris in 1975, it was the first time the American elite encountered the new French intellectuals, a lot of them very radical, who somebody calls them the French terrorists, who somebody I'm talking to, the French terrorists. No, maybe Katie brought that up. Oh, I better unplug Katie. Where is Katie? She didn't get back in. So anyways, so in 1975, here's Derrida and a bunch of people. So when Derrida gets up to make his speech, I think he's going to speak on Finney's Wake, the hosts of the Paris Symposium locked the doors so Hugh Kenner and all the famous American critics couldn't leave. And then Derrida proceeds to tell them that since Finnegan's Wake is about nothing, and that Derrida, he says, he knows nothing about Finnegan's Wake, therefore he's the world authority on Finnegan's Wake. So he's presenting a Manippean satire to the American critics. So that was pretty controversial and indicative of the Quinon style of the Manippean satirist that Derrida and his buddies were.
Mm.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, yeah, very.
So
right, I forgot about the World Fair.
Yeah, right. Who's this? This is Greenbaugh. Excuse me, Greenbaugh. But just a minute, Greenbaugh. Okay, so back to, I think we should bring in Ion to see if he would like to comment on the actualities of Joyce's syphilis, or does Joyce come in? You're welcome to participate, Ion, if you have a tantrum. Do you have something to say about whether Joyce had syphilis or not?
He did not.
How would you show that, if they've got medical ready, why is he taking medication in the case that Kevin makes? How would you refute that evidence?
Well, very simply, the medicine he was taking was for a what they thought was a viral strain.
Just a virus. Just a virus. Just a virus.
Mm-hmm. It was a form of chlamydia.
Right. So if we had Kevin here, he'd say, sir, could you verify with literate evidence your point that he didn't have syphilis? Now, we don't demand
that. The same way we would say, sir, can you describe the medicine that is only used for this application, which it is not? And then can you verify that? You can't take bullshit, try to prove bullshit.
Yeah, you're saying the medicine that Kevin cites is not used for syphilis.
Correct. Chlamydia.
Chlamydia. It's used for chlamydia, or it isn't?
Yeah. It's used for chlamydia.
Right. Okay, so the medicine that...
So you can take the paper, you can take the medicine.
Well, it's not clear, Ion. It's not clear what you're saying. So the medicine Joyce took was used for what?
Chlamydia.
Oh, that's not syphilis? I thought you just said chlamydia was syphilis.
No.
Okay. So what's chlamydia, Carol?
It's another type of infection.
Nothing to do with sexual interaction.
It is a sexually transmitted disease.
Oh, so Joyce did have a sexually transmitted disease, Ion.
Yes. No one said he didn't have a sexually transmitted disease. They said he did not have syphilis.
But he had chlamydia, Carol, and where does that come from?
It can be sexually transmitted.
It doesn't have to be, but it can be.
Okay. Was Joyce's chlamydia sexually transmitted?
Yes. Chlamydia is sexually transmitted, so yes.
But it doesn't have the damning, scandalous image of syphilis, right, Carol?
Right.
Okay, well, that's right in between. He had a sexually transmitted disease, but it wasn't syphilis. Now, how's that for subtlety, girls?
And he had bouts of gonorrhea as well.
All right, so that is an infection, and that's not respectable, is it, Carol, back then? So he had gonorrhea. So Kevin...
It would come back and it would improve. But a lot of folks did in those days. It was just not talked about. People were running around with fever blisters all the time.
Is it because they didn't have proper hygiene?
Well, it's not about hygiene, Bob. Y'all are trying to clean the world up, and it wasn't that bad. It's just the body's natural response. People ate a lot of dirty things, brushed in the dirty things.
Right, so gonorrhea is a natural response to sexual activity.
Well, no, the virus is a natural response to sexual activity.
Right, so what's the difference between gonorrhea and syphilis, Carolyn?
They're just different. They're not viral. They're bacterial organisms. Well, syphilis is a spirochete, but gonorrhea is a bacteria. They're just different organisms.
Right. So gonorrhea is not as doesn't cause brain damage or whatever they say syphilis does.
Right. It does not migrate to the brain.
Milder. Okay. So Katie's blocked. So Katie, and are you still here, Sarah?
Yes.
So what do you think of the fine distinctions ions brought into it?
I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah? What do you think, Katie?
Because he didn't die of syphilis. He died of liver cancer or
right.
something.
Okay, that's it. What did he die of, ion? Suicide, but what was the disease?
Yeah.
Boredom.
Boredom? He died of boredom?
I have it here that he died of a perforated ulcer. I remember hearing that.
Is that true, Ion?
There was a perforation in his bed.
But did that cause his death? The level below suicide. Did that...
it was the disease that claimed the body.
So it was a perforated ulcer from limited 3D perspective.
Oh, here it is. Look, January 11, 1941. He underwent surgery in Zurich for a perforated ulcer. While he at first improved, he relapsed the following day and despite several transfusions fell into a coma.
And why did he do that, Ian? Was he overlooking his body and then deciding to commit suicide?
He didn't want to. He was already done.
He was done
before he ever even had all that mess. It was just,
well, okay. Wait, when he was 22, he was done?
The world, the world was a different. He was done with the world.
Yes, and he did say that through the Evergreens. The 30s were quite shocking to him.
So the whole world turned upside down, and they said it made it all better. It undid everything he saw of value.
Everything
that he saw of having any value was destroyed immediately, gone.
That's what he said through the Evergreens.
Even the families that were portrayed as immortal were gone. They were on the street begging for food.
You mean the families, like what families, in Dublin?
Of course.
Not the characters, not the fact that the book became obsolesce by movies. You mean the actual people that he based it on, like Cranley.
Finer family. Finer families.
Right, in Dublin.
Hypocrisy would be based upon.
In Dublin, finer Irish. Yeah. So what do you think of that, Katie? So that makes Kevin's book melt away. You see how we're better than anybody?
I knew that. I just wanted to see what you would say.
Yeah, okay.
And Kevin specifically mentions the syphilis and is excited about that because he believes it to be the cause of all of Jim's eye problems, the iriditis and the need for all the surgery.
Oh, okay, there's
so
a question.
So that's not true.
What caused Joyce's eye problems, Ian?
Pink eye.
Pink, what's that, Carol? Pink eye.
Pink eye is a bacterial infection of the eye. It doesn't cause blindness and the ability that he seemed to have.
Okay, Ian, why did it go so far if it was just pink eye?
It's untreated. It just built. And it caused almost like a glaucoma effect, but shaded over the eye, which it will do, left unchecked.
Right. So it's his poverty. These are problems, health problems due to his poverty?
It scarred the lens of a cornea.
Right, but he couldn't afford doctors and proper treatment?
Didn't know. See, it's how you see things. That was not seen. To expose some of those things would be to expose that you were exposed. So it would be better to die a good life than to be exposed as a vagabond.
So as much as an anarchist in literature he seemed to be, he was a very proper following Victorian morality.
His anarchy was only based on his prim and proper capacity. Otherwise, the anarchy is just normal. You lose all the sport if you're that guy. See, no one
If you're that
a,
what guy, did you say?
Guy,
if you're that
you're
guy?
That guy. Guy.
Yeah, G-Y.
Guy.
Right. So Katie, we gotta send this, corresponding with Kevin. Let's send this whole dialogue. It'll probably be put up by Ed, and we'll see if Kevin's got the guts to come into the 21st century. He's a young guy. I saw a picture of him. Very young.
Yeah, he's under 30.
Right. Is he going to cite POB standards? Well, this guy can say whatever he wants, blah, blah, blah. Well, I think Ion makes it more interesting. I mean, Carolyn, we got a doctor here backing up the things that Ion's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah, what does the front desk say?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I think I read a quote that he did say that, you know, I've seen everything. I'm looking into, I forget the quote, I'm looking into the nothingness and I see beautiful nothingness or something. I don't know, you know, like somebody asked him what he was going to do next. He was like, it was like he was done.
Not educated. She can't even, she's going on gossip, the typical front desk. You're going on gossip. You can't even remember the quote.
No, I'm trying to remember the quote.
Well, at least just a little coffee talk.
Yeah, coffee talk.
So Ian, what did Joyce think was the reasoning for making what's called stream of consciousness as art form writing that he created and seemed to be the first? What did he think he was doing, and why did he make his aesthetic appear like that?
He was just trying to sort it. He was sorting, and that was the mishmash. That was the sorting, and rather than fix it, which he could not, he said, go with it, and he did.
So it's messy writing. He was trying to handle so much, and it just could only be messy because he was working on many.
He was sorting the dirty laundry, and then it couldn't get sorted, so he just let it go.
And then he tried a game with Finnegan's Wake?
Well, try, trick, try, throw, throw.
Try, throw, throw. So, Katie, what question does that evoke in you on this angle?
Someone remarked, who was in that group of Ezra and all those people, that James Talent had run away from him.
Right.
Is that saying the same thing?
Everyone was.
Well, that's the genius of Marsh McLuhan. Marsh McLuhan got beyond that judgment and created a new purpose for
Ion. The only reason he got beyond it was because of Wyndham Lewis.
That's right, exactly.
Wyndham Lewis, he would have never had that connection.
That's right. Lewis gave him a way out. So that's why Don Fields says that McLuhan faked his Joyce in interest on behalf because he was a closet Lewisite. That's Don Fields' thesis.
Well, one thing that I didn't mention from the article last week, too, was that I didn't know that Wyndham was James' biggest, like it was his arch critic. I didn't know that.
Yes.
No. T.S. Eliot was the arch critic, but.
but Lewis understood. Eliot did pretty good in writing on Ulysses, but Lewis was the first to take Finnegan's Wake as it was being shown in journals. It was called Work in Progress, and as early as 1928, he satirized Finnegan's Wake. You know, most people aren't even acknowledging Finney's Wake. Lewis knew what Joyce was getting at and presented a counter view of it. That's the genius of Lewis. He mirrored Finney's Wake long before it was published, or the final version was published. So that's where Lewis is better than Eliot.
So is Apes of God about all these people?
Yes, exactly. And Apes of God is his attempt to redo Ulysses and Finney's Wake better, because Lewis thought that Joyce was presenting an ear bias, and the Western genius was based on the eye. So it's very hard to read Apes of God, but it's written as a painter would describe things, like, you know, like Sheila or Sarah, they look at the fine details of a face, then that's what that Lewis would write, and so you get very lost in the visual details. So he emphasized the visual.
Two chapters of the eyebrows, like Sheila. On 3 months on the eyelashes.
Right, that's Lewis, to spend two chapters on the eyebrows, and maybe showing eyebrows in different people. But the so Lewis, his is visually explicit, and most people get a sense of flow from Ulysses and Phineas Wake, so they go for the music of it. And there's a whole history of this. It's really incredible, written by Vincent Sherry. And he explains the historical, intellectual, critical roots of the eye versus the ear 100 years before Joyce. And it's all these writers and thinkers that no one hears about now, but there was an eye versus ear aesthetic battle. Basically, those that did not like the increasing mob idea that, say, the telegraph and modern access and technology in the second half of the 19th century that led to mob solidarity and Marxism and socialism and all this. So those that liked middle class solitude or aristocratic solitude, they valued the eye versus the hoi polloi that was in the ear. And that's what Lewis and Lewis adopted. And Joyce knew of it, and Joyce claimed to be in the tactile position, neither eye nor ear.
He was such a good singer, supposedly, and musician,
yes.
And his wife wished he would just be a musician and not write.
In the Joyce James's Dublin Center I went to, you know, back in August, they went into detail about that. I mean, he was a friend of John MacDonald, whoever the famous Irish singer of that era was, and Joyce competed with him in contest, you know, when he's 21, 22, and he almost beat John, whatever his name is, the famous Irish singer. That's how good he was. So here's Lewis, a fantastic painter coming out of art school, and Joyce, a fantastic singer, and they acted out their bias. But Joyce felt he was more comprehensive than Lewis. But see, Lewis was going for the media causes of why people favored Cubism or favored Stein or favored all the guys that become famous. Lewis is saying, oh, these are just dupes of the radio. He said the major museum that wouldn't have his portraits, famous portraits, genius portraits in 1938, whatever it was called, the Royal Something British Museum, he said that museum is just a dupe of the photograph. That's a broad, technical, McLuhan media ecology statement, and nobody knew what he was talking about, but he could say that. So he prefigured McLuhan more than Joyce did. But McLuhan knew that Lewis was considered a Nazi and everything, so he had to prop up Joyce. And that's what Don Field complains about, that McLuhan was working on the media ecological level that Lewis started and projecting on Joyce, and Joyce was not that. And these dynamics are in my tiny note chart.
So, Ion, was Joyce as sexual as he writes about, or did he spend any time talking to the girls that he visited in Nighttown, or was he really in there disengaging them sexually?
He was mortified of females, scared to death.
And why is that? Why would
he didn't understand them.
So even though women think that his presentation of Molly is profoundly a profound understanding of women, well then how's that happen? So what,
because
he understood women later?
He couldn't do it in real life, but he knew how to describe it.
Oh, I see. Right. He's so abstract about it, inner thought about it. But
those who can't do, teach.
Yeah, good point.